There is this thing. Do you realize
what is there?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting not live, but still from Montreal. My name is Amy Lloyd.
And I'm Maya Ibbotson.
Today we broadcast from the Geoziage, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations.
Today, we are airing a segment investigating the Canadian prison system's intersection with the COVID-19 pandemic. We've previously discussed this issue on Unfit, but we want to revisit it after the tragic passing of Kimberly Squirrel a few months ago. We'll be talking about prisons' lack of release systems, COVID-19 in Quebec prisons, and prison abolition. We want to issue a content warning, as this segment mentions anti-Black racism, police brutality, anti-Indigenous racism, and death. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after a short music break.
Through these
Men I Trust with I Hope to Be Around, followed by Pink Soda with Not the Sad Yearning Because You Went Away. Now for our weekly headline roundup. Outcries have been voiced after Ontario's provincial government announced a new partnership with Mohawk College that will cost $2.5 million annually in taxpayer money to pay corrections recruits during training. This new program to train new prison guard recruits is coupled with a $500 million investment in provincial corrections announced in June 2020. This included updating outdated jails and hiring new frontline staff within Ontario provincial jail systems. According to the press secretary at the Office of the Solicitor General, quote, "The training was modernized to provide officers with more job-specific case studies and scenario-based learning with an emphasis on human rights, Indigenous cultural competency training, and inmate management techniques," unquote. Of course, as we will touch upon in our audio essay playing later, this is not enough to stop institutional racism embedded in correctional facilities. To learn more about this program and how to advocate against it, Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project has spoken to the Toronto Star about it in a really great article.
Last month, McGill Admin sent out an email informing the student population that we will be returning to on-campus learning in the fall. However, that promise is still 6 months away, so we're going to summarize what we know so far while things remain uncertain. As reported by the McGill Daily, quote, "As the government expects that high-risk people will be vaccinated well before the fall, all students are expected to be on campus for the fall semester. The university does not plan on implementing a hybrid learning model, meaning courses may not have a remote option." During the March 12th town hall, Deputy Provost of Student Life and Learning, Fabrice Laveau, presented a rough outline of McGill's various contingency plans for the fall semester, with scenarios ranging from red alert equivalent to optimistic. Because the government claims that a high percentage of the population will be vaccinated by September, the university anticipates more relaxed public health measures come fall. This means the majority of classes will be held on campus, though classes and exams with more than 150 people will be conducted remotely. Students who must attend both in-person and online classes will be able to make use of quote-unquote flex spaces, which allow for noisy work, such as participating in a video call, unlike traditional libraries. Furthermore, the university hopes to have a vaccination center available for students and employees. Per Laveau, McGill may establish a vaccination center once the general population, i.e. those aged from 16 to 60 years, who do not have underlying conditions, start receiving vaccinations. However, the university does not expect students to present proof of vaccination in order to enter campus buildings. What is needed for entry, though, is a procedural mask. These will be distributed at different buildings throughout campus. Now we're going to read out some of the more specific guidelines. So what you need to know if you will be a first-year student this fall, residences will be open. Furthermore, all first-year students are guaranteed university housing. Because the university is primarily focusing on academic planning, the status of extracurricular activities such as frosh is still uncertain. If you are at risk of severe COVID-19 symptoms, according to the Canadian government, those with pre-existing conditions will be prioritized for the COVID-19 vaccine. As such, the university assumes that all high-risk students will be able to attend class on campus next fall. However, according to Associate Provost Christopher Buttle, the university will work with faculties to ensure flexibility for students who are in need of accommodations. If you're an international student, While international travel is currently restricted and will likely remain restricted this September, students with a valid study permit can enter Canada. The university is currently working with the government to speed up the process of acquiring necessary documents. However, if you need to obtain or renew your documentation, you should do so as soon as possible. Upon entering Canada, you will need to quarantine in a hotel for 3 days. However, the university is providing a bursary for students who cannot afford the hotel quarantine. What's more, Lubo claims that although most outlets report that the cost of hotel quarantine is about $2,000, in practice, quarantining tends to be around $900 to $1,200. The university does not expect the students will be required to present proof of vaccination to enter the country. While it is uncertain whether this policy will remain, international students are currently able to receive the vaccine in Canada, unquote. All this information can be found on the McGill Daily website under the news section.
Content warning, this headline contains mentions of death and anti-Asian racism. In the wake of last week's hate crimes in Georgia, which left 8 dead, 6 of whom were Asian female sex workers, advocates in Montreal gathered on Sunday to protest violence against Asian Americans and Canadians. Thousands gathered at Cabot Square to march in downtown Montreal to denounce the rise in anti-Asian racism since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. The march continued throughout Montreal's downtown core and ended with a vigil for Asian lives lost this year to hate crimes, especially those who were murdered in Georgia last week. In Montreal, police say that acts of violence against Asian communities have increased by at least 5 over the past year. According to Global News, quote, Montreal police say a total of 30 crimes targeting the Asian community were recorded in 2020 between the months of March and December. Of those, 22 were considered heinous crimes and 8 were recorded as hate crimes, unquote. A police spokesperson also said that 1/3 of the incidents recorded were related to the COVID-19 pandemic and were fueled by racist sentiment. Majority of the cases, 40% specifically, were involving vandalism and graffiti. Organizers for the protest, when speaking to Global News, called upon François Legault to finally acknowledge the existence of systemic racism in Quebec in the wake of these horrific incidents, something which he has notably refused to do in the past.
This week is CKUT's annual funding drive. As stated on our site, quote, CKUT is not for profit, but is not a registered charity and could not issue tax receipts for donations. The National Campus Community Radio Station Association is working on this issue so that more campus community radio stations can be granted charitable status, unquote. CKUT is freeform radio, grassroots, corporate-free, independent media. Unfit is just one of the many shows that aims to cover essential events and host cultural conversations, often challenging the mainstream discourse that we see in other forms of media. Founded in 1987, CKUT is a part of the McGill and Montreal history, as well as our community as a whole, providing a space for students like us to hone our production and journalism skills. As a community source, we need support, so consider donating to the CKUT annual fund. What's in it for you if you donate, you ask? Well, a $30 donation means you can get a CKUT zine, or zine, I'm not really sure how to pronounce it, and one entry for the grand prize draw. $60 is one shirt and one entry for the grand prize draw. $90 is a shirt, a tote bag, and one entry for the grand prize draw. $120 donation or a $10 donation every month or more gets you one shirt, one tote bag, one toque, and 2 entries to the grand prize draw. So you can donate at our funding site, which is http://funding.ckut.ca, which will also be in our link tree, as you all know. So go check that out and please support CKUT. We love CKUT. Woo! That was our weekly headline roundup. So now it's time for a quick and groovy tune and then our audio essay.
I'll take care of you if you want me to. Always ready for your love. I'll take care of you if you want me to. I'm always ready for your love.
Wait for it, you'll come around like I've prayed for it. Wearing your cross on my chain for it. even the blind to believe. Oh, oh, but stay for I'll part the sea 7 days for down on my knees as you came for time's over me. To the moon and back twice for it. All for our love. Oh, I'll be nice for it. I take a breath, close my eyes for it. Still wanna leave on the lights for it.
I'll take care of you.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. That was Charlotte Day Wilson with Take Care of You, feat. Sid, followed by Whitetown with Your Woman.
Now it's time for our segment discussing COVID-19's disproportionate impact on incarcerated peoples. For this audio essay and for our contribution to the National Day of Action, we want to spread awareness in regards to this crisis in Canada. As we are based in Montreal, we will be talking about Quebec prison systems, specifically the Laval Migrant Detention Center, and the spread of COVID-19 there. We will also discuss prison abolition as a theory and as a movement, why it's necessary, especially in the face of the pandemic. We want to issue a content warning, as this segment mentioned anti-Black racism, police brutality, anti-Indigenous racism, and death.
Unfit has discussed mass incarceration, COVID-19, and the intersection between the two on the show before. However, a recent tragedy has forced us to revisit this ever-present issue. Kimberly Squirrel, a Yellow Quill First Nations mother of six, was found frozen to death on January 20th, 3 days after her release date from Pine Grove Province Jail for women in Prince Arthur, Saskatchewan. Squirrel's death highlights the larger issue surrounding a lack of infrastructure for a release system for formerly incarcerated people. Access to aftercare, reintegration, or even basic necessities are not readily available once people leave prison. In the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, aftercare and reintegration became even more crucial, as infrastructures that were formerly available are now closed for social distancing reasons. The incident surrounding Squirrel's passing also brings forth a bigger issue about prisons. Of course, the nature of prison infrastructure allows for inappropriate social distancing matters during COVID-19. However, apart from the pandemic, the existence of prisons remains harmful. The entire prison system is a major issue in any society before, during, and after incarceration. Those entering prisons often have improper accounts of justice, which determines their sentencing severity and length. Once inside prisons, incarcerated people are faced with overcrowded and unsafe conditions. And as we just mentioned, an evident lack of release system does not provide opportunities for individuals who were formerly detained.
As researchers flag an increase in COVID-19 cases in Canadian jails, we must revisit the pre-existing issues surrounding prisons and the justice system, and how they are exacerbated by the pandemic. According to Statistics Canada, there was a decrease in incarcerated people in Canadian jails between February and April of this year. The bulk of the decline was seen in provincial jails, where numbers dropped 25%, whereas they only dropped 1% in federal prisons. In their report, Statistics Canada wrote that these numbers were, quote unquote, unprecedented, as only, quote, slight variations, unquote, are usually observed over longer periods of time. The highest declines were observed in Nova Scotia's provincial jail population, where Statistics Canada reported a massive 41% drop in the prison population. These declines came amongst growing calls from advocates and Public Safety Minister Bill Blair himself, all advocating for a reduction of the number of people in custody. As previously mentioned, the spread of COVID-19 in prisons has been a real and problematic issue. As of August 10th, according to CTV News, 360 incarcerated people at federal prisons tested positive for coronavirus, two of which died, the rest of which had been removed. A different research paper reporting on the overall incarcerated population of Canada, however, notes that, quote, from March to the end of November, there were 1,864 reported novel coronavirus cases amongst prisoners and jail staff in Canada, more than half of which were in October and November. Since December 1st, there have been over 1,962 cases, unquote. According to the Prisoners' Rights Project, quote, as of March 11th, 2021, there have been 6,713 COVID-19 cases linked to Canadian carceral institutions. 4,971 of those cases are prisoners, unquote. Consider, however, that incarcerated people make up 80% of those COVID-19 cases. Canadian justice systems have begun to take a few steps, including the early release of low-risk offenders and extending parole.
In the wake of the tragic passing of Kimberly Squirrel, it's necessary to understand the other events occurring in Canada's prison system at the moment. Amidst concerns of COVID-19 spread in jails, many individuals are being released from these prisons on parole. However, this makes the lack of release system now more apparent than ever. To compensate for the large number of releases, Canada must account for their pre-existing lack of social support for formerly detained individuals, especially as the pandemic continues to make life harder for all of us, especially marginalized communities. Furthermore, March 20th, which has just passed, marked the National Day of Action as mobilized by the Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project. The Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project held three different rallies across the city, protesting the poor conditions those in prisons are subject to. These rallies took place at the Maplehurst Correctional Complex, Caravan from Maplehurst to Toronto South, and another rally at Toronto South Detention Center. March 20th marks 1 year since the first incarcerated individual in Canada contracted COVID-19. The government, though taking small steps such as release, have and will continue to fail prisoners, outside the context of the pandemic as well. For this audio essay and for our contribution to the National Day of Action, we want to spread awareness in regards to this crisis in Canada. As we are based in Montreal, we will be talking about Quebec prison systems, specifically the Laval Migrant Detention Center and the spread of COVID-19 there. We will also discuss prison abolition, not just as a theory, but as a movement, and why it's necessary, especially in the face of the pandemic.
In March of 2020, the incarcerated peoples at the Laval Migrant Detention Center went on a hunger strike for 10 days, requesting that they be released due to the high risk of exposure to the coronavirus in prisons. In April, some incarcerated individuals at the center were in fact released. However, the Canada Border Services Agency still requires individual hearings for each detainee before their release, meaning their release was not immediate. Solidarity Across Borders, a Montreal-based migrant justice organization, released an article in March 2020 that detailed the experience of those in the center, saying, quote, "In the detention center, we are in a confined space. Every day we see the arrival of people, of immigrants from everywhere, who have had no medical appointment nor any test to determine whether they are potential carriers of the virus. There is also the presence of security staff who are in contact with the external world every day and also have not had any testing," unquote.
People in prisons already have poor access to healthcare, but on top of this, necessary social distancing measures instructed by medical professionals are violated in prisons due to the close living quarters and how frequently large groups gather. Lucie Lemond is a representative of the Ligue des Droits et Libertés, a Quebec-based human rights organization who stated that there is, quote, "a lack of personal protective equipment and soap in jails," unquote. Incarcerated people are also at a risk of exposure to the virus from guards going in and out of the prisons, who have exposure to the outside world. In March 2020, at the Hamilton-Wentworth Detention Center in Hamilton, Ontario, an employee contracted the virus and exposed roughly 560 individuals in detention. To quote the McGill Daily, "We cannot allow those in positions of authority to further abuse their power and put the most vulnerable at risk of contracting a potentially fatal virus," unquote. Going back to the lack of support people receive after release, an individual in detention upon his release was given a bus ticket and was not given the opportunity to make a phone call, as well as being told that he could not access official housing for refugees. Even after being released, incarcerated people are not provided with any support or security, showing this consistent cycle of harm.
The issues within prison systems remained as the pandemic continued. On May 19th, 2020, Robert Langevin died from the coronavirus. He was an incarcerated person at Montreal's Bordeaux prison. Geneviève Gibault, the Quebec Minister of Public Safety, stated that Langevin's death was unfortunate, but claimed that the government was still taking measures to slow the spread of the virus. However, social distancing measures, which would limit the spread of infection, are not being fully met in Quebec prisons. Starting in June 2020, the measures being taken by the government, which Gibault spoke of, include providing masks to prison staff, limiting incarcerated people's activities, which could increase the risk of infection, and subjecting areas of the prison to a 24-hour lockdown. According to the Anti-Carceral Group, a Canada-based prison abolitionist organization, for many incarcerated people, this means, quote, no access to television, showers, or reading material, unquote. However, in June of 2020, the rate of infection in prisons in Canada was 14 times higher than the population, highlighting the insufficient actions of the government when it comes to protecting incarcerated peoples from the virus.
A year later, the incarcerated people at the Laval Migrant Detention Center have gone on a second hunger strike, protesting the lack of sufficient health care at the prison and reminding the general public that essential demands still have not been met. Despite the claims by the Quebec government 10 months ago of increased safety measures in prisons, an individual at the center wrote that, quote, the Laval Detention Center is a place where the virus can spread, and it is only a matter of time before we're all infected, unquote. According to Harsha Walia, an activist for migrant justice, in the Laval Detention Center, one-third of individuals in the detention center have tested positive for the virus. When the first hunger strike occurred in March of 2020, a majority of inmates were released. However, the center is becoming overcrowded once again, but no COVID protection measures have been changed. Carlos Martin, an incarcerated person who contracted COVID-19, in an interview with Global News, stated that he had, quote, seen some guards that had the same symptoms that I had and didn't use gloves, that took off masks, unquote. Further, to quote The Daily, when inmates test positive for COVID-19, they are placed in solitary confinement without access to psychological services, unquote. Solitary confinement is an inhumane practice, and this is another example of the harm and violence caused by the prison system, both in and outside of the context of the pandemic. Further, for almost a year, visits to the prison have been suspended, placing detained individuals in complete isolation without any mental health resources. Issues which the pandemic has prompted, such as psychological effects of isolation, are exacerbated within the prison system. Prisons are oppressive, unproductive systems. However, many are still concerned with the question, well, if prisons are bad, what will replace them? We will now discuss the necessity for prison abolition and the effects of prisons outside of the context of the pandemic.
It is evident that prisons are obsolete both during and outside of COVID-19. Discourse regarding prison abolition entered the mainstream this summer amidst worldwide BLM rallies and peaceful protests. Part of that discourse included the reality that Black, Brown, and Indigenous people are often overrepresented in the prison system. To counteract the harmful and violent consequences of the prison system, prison abolitionists argue to get rid of the system as a whole, as opposed to reforming it. Earlier and significant works on prison abolition include figures like Angela Davis and Ruth Wilson Gilmore. Although the solution of prison abolition has entered the mainstream, the debate remains between abolition versus revision. People have argued that implementing diverse leadership will help in avoiding the racial inequalities reflected in the statistics of the incarcerated demographic. However, in an interview with GQ, Woods Urban, an organizer with the Critical Resistance, which is a prison abolition organization started by Davis and Wilson, explains that, quote, abolition is a political vision with a goal of eliminating imprisonment, policing, and surveillance, and creating lasting alternatives to punishment and imprisonment. That it's not just about getting rid of building cages. It's about actually undoing the society that continues to feed on and maintain the oppression of masses of people through punishment, violence, and control. Because the prison industrial complex isn't an isolated system, abolition is a broad strategy. And so we have to be building models today that develop and represent how we want to live in the future. It's both a practical organizing tool and a long-term goal. The prison industrial complex isn't broken. It's doing exactly what it's meant to do. By calling for any of these reforms, you immediately re-entrench the logic that is underpinning its systemic nature. The prison industrial complex, both prisons, policing, and surveillance, they feed off of reform. With each iteration, they've gotten bigger, more deeply entrenched into our communities, and more powerful, unquote.
Woods continues on, promoting transformative justice and prompting us to reimagine our institutions and what safety really means. They say, quote, abolition calls on you to really use your imagination in ways that have become counterintuitive for lots of people. Because of what Miriam Kaba calls the cop in our head and cop in our heart, We've been indoctrinated by a society that's been using policing and prison to answer for every social and political problem. Because of this, we have very little practice with the muscle of imagining and solving systemic problems within prison sentences. Depending on the scenario, if you have capacities within your neighborhood to solve a problem, you would call on your neighbor. If there is an emergency that's beyond you or somebody who lives in proximity to you and is not trained to be able to handle that the emergency that you are experiencing, there are models from around the world of direct responders who are trained in a variety of kinds of response that are particular to the emergency that you are having, unquote.
Prisons hinder and harm communities of color. In Canada specifically, as stated by the John Howard Society of Canada, quote, Aboriginal and Black people are more likely to be victims of crime. The Aboriginal murder rate in Canada is 7 to 8 times higher than the overall rate. In Toronto, where Black people are 4% of the population, they account for as many as 40% of murder victims, unquote. However, despite this, young Black people are still more likely to be stopped by the police than young white people. According to the John Howard Society of Canada, an analysis of 10,000 arrests in Toronto showed that Black people were 50% more likely to be taken to a police station for processing after arrest, and 100% more likely to be held overnight than were white people, even taking into account criminal history and age. When given bail, they had more conditions imposed, unquote. In regards to the prisons in Canada, Indigenous and Black populations are overrepresented in these systems. As stated by the John Howard Society of Canada, Black folks, quote, are overrepresented in federal prisons by more than 300% versus their population, while for Indigenous folks, the overrepresentation is nearly 500%, unquote.
In provinces like Nova Scotia, Black people make up 2% of the population, yet represent 14% of the prison population. In Manitoba, Indigenous people make up 16% of the population, but 70% of the prison population. In Alberta, Indigenous people represent 6% of the general population and make up 39% of the prison population. John Howard Society found that Indigenous folks are more likely to be, quote, subject to disciplinary procedures and less likely to be paroled. Indigenous people make up more than 21% of federal prisoners, but less than 14% of parolees, a 50% underrepresentation, unquote. These statistics go back to this inadequate and unacceptable release system we discussed earlier, showcasing the violence that continues to take place outside of the physical prison environment. It is evident that prisons are a part of a bigger system of policing, a system that ensures institutional inequality exacerbated by class and race. With this debate of reforming versus replacing systems, it is important to consider the following. Research proves that prisons do an inefficient job of solving violence and protecting the general public. It is also important to note that prisons are responsible for labor exploitation as well. But the question remains, if prisons don't work, what can we do to protect general populations as well as provide resources for those who have committed crimes in the past? According to The Guardian, quote, people that pose a risk to the community should be heavily monitored and controlled, but this can be done outside standard prison environments. Community corrections is already a part of Australia's criminal justice system and has been found to effectively control and treat offending behavior, unquote.
In this model, those who are considered a threat report to a case manager, work on themselves through educational programs, treatment programs, and community programs. This model is intrinsically more therapeutic, providing services for mental health and addiction. The Guardian goes on to explain, quote, for other forms of offending, a financial penalty may be more effective than a prison sentence. For example, many forms of white-collar crime are motivated by pursuit of status. Public naming and shaming, hefty fines, and bans on certain forms of professional practice are more likely to deter white-collar offending than prison. Moreover, victim-centered alternatives to standard prison sentences can provide empowerment for victims of crime. Restorative justice is a system of criminal justice that focuses on the rehabilitation of offenders through reconciliation with victims and the community at large, unquote. We can think back to the college admissions scandal. Many of the offenders received short sentences, all serving time under a year. If those parents were persecuted financially, maybe the general public would have felt justice was served and the issue of capitalism, elitism, and academia was thoroughly addressed. Additionally, there needs to be a legislative revision when it comes to victimless crimes such as drug possession and sex work. This can be done through approaches such as justice reinvestment, a data-driven approach that harnesses, quote, the cost savings of lower rates of imprisonment by reinvesting the funds into areas at risk of crime. The approach is evidence-based, following decades of research from public health that a focus on prevention is often more cost-effective than focusing solely on a cure, unquote.
Justice reinvestment looks elsewhere to support communities usually targeted by this policing system. This reinvestment sets up infrastructure where said communities now have the funding to work within their own spaces, protecting the people in those spaces, and working to overcome challenges they face. If we focus on mutual aid solutions, community-oriented solutions, we can begin to promote sovereignty and self-governance, which is essential for communities of color in the context of colonial systems, such as the entirety of so-called Canada. Overall, it is evident from our brief research that prisons are in fact obsolete. In order to remedy the harm that they have caused and continue to cause, the only solution is for prisons to be abolished. From there, we can start to do the tangible and intellectual work to rethink how we police bodies and why we do so in the first place. That's all we have for today, folks. We will now be reading our resource list, which can be found in our link tree in our bio. Search for unfit_2print.
So first up, we have Solidarity Across Borders. It's just a link to their donation page, but obviously you can check out their page as a whole. SAB is a migrant justice network based in Montreal since 2003. To quote their website, we organize together to support individuals and families who are confronting an unjust immigration and refugee system, unquote. To support this organization, you can donate to them through PayPal or e-transfer at solidaritysansfrontieres@gmail.com. or subscribe to their mailing list to stay informed.
Next, we have the Anti-Carceral Group. So this is just a link to their website. The Anti-Carceral Group is a prison abolitionist organization based in Canada working to fight injustices in the prison system. They have a Facebook group, which meets once a month to, quote, their website, learn, discuss, and act on prison justice issues, unquote. You can also check out their website, noprisons.ca, which has a lot of more important information on prison abolition and prisons during the pandemic.
Then we have the Critical Resistance website link. To quote their page, Critical Resistance seeks to build an international movement to end prison industrial complex by challenging the belief that caging and controlling people makes us safe. We believe that basic necessities such as food, shelter, and freedom are what really make our communities secure. As such, our work is part of a global struggles against inequality and powerlessness. The success of the movement requires that it reflect communities most affected by the PIC. Because we seek to abolish the PIC, we cannot support any work that extends its life or scope.
Next up, we have a fund that's supported by the Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project, which we actually did an episode on last year that you can check out if you want to know more about prison reform. But this is called the Prisoner Emergency Support Fund. And to quote the website, this fund is intended for people inside prisons and jails and recently released prisoners. People behind bars often need support to contact their loved ones or purchase essential items on their canteen. Recently released prisoners need access to funds for housing, food, clothing, and physical and mental health supports. Families who still have loved ones behind bars need funds for expensive phone bills and canteens, unquote. So if you want to send a donation over there, I know that they have a lot of prisoners writing to them for support.
Next, we have a GoFundMe for Hyung Jun Kim's sons. Hyung Jun Grant, maiden name Kim, was one of the victims of the shootings in Atlanta, Georgia at Gold Spa. This GoFundMe, started by Kim's sons, will go towards money for their housing, food, bills, etc. So it'd be great if you could check that out.
And lastly, we have another GoFundMe for John Shen's grandmother. Shen's grandmother was a victim of a racially motivated attack. This GoFundMe will go towards her medical expenses, therapy treatment, and bills in general. So once again, go check that out and donate if you can. Well, thank you so much for listening, and we hope that you found our audio essay on the prison system and COVID interesting and informative. Well, Welcome back. You're listening to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Thanks for tuning in this week for Unfit. Much appreciated, as always. Come back next week at the same time for another show. Again, don't forget your last reminder for today. This week is CKUT's annual funding drive. As stated on the CKUT website, CKUT is not for profit, but is not a registered charity and cannot therefore issue tax receipts for donations. The National Campus Community Radio Station Association is working on this issue so that more campus community radio stations can be granted charitable status, unquote. So, as Amy mentioned before, CKUT is freeform radio, grassroots, corporate-free, independent media. Unfit is just one of the many shows that aims to cover essential events and hosts cultural conversations, often challenging the mainstream discourse. Founded in 1987, CKUT is a part of McGill and Montreal history, as well as our community as a whole, providing space for students like us to hone our production and journalism skills. As a community source, we need your support. Consider donating to CKUT Annual Fund. What's in it for you? If you donate, you ask. Well, we have some fun donations. For $30, you can get a CKUT zine while supplies last. I'm going to go with zine, even though we're not confirmed on that pronunciation, and one entry for the grand prize draw. $60 donation is one shirt plus one entry for the grand prize draw. A $90 donation is one shirt, one tote bag, and one entry for the grand prize draw. And $120 donation, or $10 monthly or more, is one shirt, one tote bag, one tooth, and two entries for the grand prize. You can donate at funding.ckut.ca. Playing us out, we have Phoebe Bridgers with Motion Sickness, followed by Les Shirley with 1994.
Hardly feel anything, I hardly CKUT shut down our studios for the safety of each other. Gradually, we adapted and found ways to continue to produce programming that reflects our shared experience, physically distanced but socially connected. Help us keep that connection by donating to CKUT. Call 514-448-4013. Pop a check in the mail, 3647 University Montreal, H3A2B3, or donate online at ckut.ca.
Episode 2 yung nga, ulimi March 16, 2021, ang malo ni Pibumit itong nga sagot si. Tusak sa ulang ayo, nansi ang ngilit, alin na itong ngilang mo, o kalimatilugo, sanang wang nakakatangan no. Ang malo tiin episode 2, apat sa ulang ang miyok, Nick Hansen mi, dan Eskimo Ninja, American Ninja Warrior mi, takot sa uso. Ang malo, inutitok to ni Nicho tinito sa katalang ang atsa. So, nalatoy na katsik. Hi, my name is Annie Pisuti. Today is March 16.